The Fourth District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has now convened. The Honorable Robert J. Steigman presiding.
Thank you, Mr. Bailiff. This is our case number 421-0355, People of the State of Illinois versus Charles Drain. Counsel for the appellant, would you please state your name?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Blair Dalton on behalf of the appellant, Charles Drain.
Okay, and counsel for the appellee?
Timothy James Londrigan, counsel for appellee, representing State's Attorney's Appellate Prosecutor's Office.
Okay, thank you, counsel. Ms. Dalton, you may proceed on behalf of the appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. At the outset, this case is asking for a similar analysis in which this court conducted in Sadiq, with a couple of additional issues for review. Those issues namely are, was the initial traffic stop of Mr. Drain valid? Was he subjected to a custodial interrogation without the benefit of Miranda warnings? Assuming the court were to find the initial stop was lawful, was it prolonged beyond the time reasonably necessary to complete the mission of the stop? And assuming it was prolonged, was that continued detention supported by probable cause? And finally, did the state fail to establish the reliability of the dog's positive alert on Mr. Drain's vehicle to prove the warrantless search of his vehicle was reasonable? Starting with the first issue, was the initial traffic stop valid? The appellant argued—
Counsel, excuse me, good afternoon. On that subject, I do have a question for you. We know that the section of the statute that applies 907C says in relevant part that a person who drives an approaching vehicle shall, proceeding with due caution, yield the right of way by making a lane change into a lane not adjacent to that of the authorized emergency vehicle, if possible, with due regard to safety and traffic conditions. Now, you argue that it wasn't possible for the defendant to change lanes due to the semi tractor trailer that was in the lane next to him. But the trial court found otherwise, and there are factors that would support that decision, are there not? It was a clear day. There were no obstructions. The squad car's lights were on. The officer actually stood out there and pointed in the direction that he thought the defendant should move his car. So why is the trial court's decision against the manifest weight of the evidence?
Well, Your Honor, I appreciate the question. Although all of those factors were indeed true at the time of the stop, what the law is stating is that upon approaching the stationary vehicle, there's no specification in Scott's law as to when an approaching vehicle needs to make that lane change into the furthest lane away from the stationary vehicle. The trial court got it wrong in a couple of ways, the most important being that the trial court indicated in its ruling that Mr. Drain did not even attempt to get over into the furthest lane, and that was not corroborated by the video evidence collected from the deputy's car, which showed that Mr. Drain's brake lights were on. That was also corroborated by the deputy's testimony. The deputy further had admitted that if Mr. Drain had attempted to get into the left lane at the time he was approaching or passing the stationary vehicle while maintaining the same rate of speed as the semi, possible he would have hit the semi, thereby showing that it would have been unsafe if he had maintained that same speed of the semi. So in braking and trying to get behind the semi before approaching and passing the stationary vehicle, Mr. Drain was attempting to substantially comply with Scott's law. And that's what the evidence established.
Now, I'm not sure I followed what you said, because the slowing down would be subsection 2. I was referring to subsection 1. And the trial court said that 2 really didn't apply. I believe there were 11 seconds or so in the video, if one were to watch the video, between the time defendant's car became visible and then passed, and then the truck was visible, or the truck pulling the trailer was visible also. and the car, defendant's car was behind the truck. So there were 11 seconds between, at least 11 seconds, between the time that that became visible, the two vehicles became visible, and the defendant passed the car, the squad car. So why it wouldn't have been possible, he was braking anyway, I'm not sure I follow what you were saying, because it's not a question of slowing down, it's a question of moving over. And we also have in the record the fact that the defendant told the officer spontaneously as he was getting into the officer's squad car that he didn't know about the law, that he had to pull over into the next lane.
So, Your Honor, to answer your question, under the first section, C1, that a car is supposed to yield the right of way by making that lane change and furthest away from the stationary vehicle has to be, if it's possible, with due regard for safety and traffic conditions. And the argument is that it wasn't possible while he was approaching and passing the stationary vehicle, because at that time, the semi was next to him. He certainly attempted to do so, but by the time he approached and passed the stationary vehicle, he wasn't able to do so. I think it bears mentioning that the Scott's Law itself is not written very clearly. It doesn't specify anything other than while approaching the stationary vehicle. So that's a very objective term to use, both for the officer who's going to conduct the stop, as well as the driver who may be stopped under Scott's Law. But without more, just the mere fact that the law states upon approaching makes it clear that in this case, with the video evidence as it is clear that Mr. Drain's vehicle attempted to slow down to get into the furthest lane. And I think the other section of your question,
Counsel,
Your Honor.
Counsel, is that based only on the fact that when he's essentially even with the squad car, his brake lights are on?
I think it's clear that his brake lights were on prior to passing the squad car based upon where his car is in line with the 18-wheeler. So you see that his car is backing further and further and further behind the 18-wheeler as he's approaching and passing the stationary vehicle, which indicates that he had been braking before he got up to the squad vehicle.
Right, but why would he be attempting to do that if he didn't even think it was required?
Well, I think that that particular issue is answered by the video itself. So the deputy asks Mr. Drain if he's aware of Scott's Law in name. And Mr. Drain responds, he is not. Now, I think that there are very many people in the state of Illinois who are not aware of traffic violations by their specific name, that being Scott's Law. Many people react just instinctively that they need to slow down and attempt to get furthest away from a stationary vehicle with lights on, which our argument is exactly what Mr. Jane was trying to do in this case.
Counsel, I have a question. The issue before this court isn't the sufficiency of the evidence to convict the defendant of this traffic violation. The issue before this court is the trial court's ruling on the defendant's motion to suppress. And filed that motion to suppress on the claim that the police officer who stopped the vehicle did not have probable cause to do so based upon the alleged violation of Scott's Law. So the issue then is, based upon the testimony of the police officer and the other evidence before the trial court, did the officer have probable cause to believe that Scott's Law had been violated, thus justifying his pulling over the defendant? And in making its determination, the trial court hears the officer and considers all this evidence and decides whether or not the defendant has met his burden of demonstrating that the Fourth Amendment was violated, that this evidence needs to be suppressed. But isn't the fundamental issue before the trial court in this case whether the officer acted reasonably, whether his belief that Scott's Law was violated was reasonable? And given the evidence before the trial court, on what basis can we conclude that the court's concluding that the officer acted reasonably was contrary to the manifest weight of the evidence?
Well, Your Honor, I think an officer might have a reasonable belief of a traffic infraction at the time that it's occurring. But if video evidence later reveals that the driver did not commit that traffic offense, then that rules the day, and the stop should be held invalid and unlawful at its inception.
Pausing again, the trial court heard the officer's description of the fairly lengthy time that passed from the time he first saw the defendant and this truck and the circumstances, and the officer's conclusion that the defendant could have and should have moved over to the left, indeed making the unusual, paying the usual step of gesturing, pointing him over to the left lane, and he still disregarded. Why isn't that enough for the trial court to conclude that the officer acted reasonably, that the officer reasonably concluded there was probable cause to believe that Scott's law had been violated?
Because the video evidence contradicted the officer's original reasonable belief that a Scott's law violation had been had happened. The video evidence showed
that your client couldn't have moved during the 11 seconds from the right lane to the left lane?
That's not what I'm arguing, Judge. I'm arguing
I'm asking. Did the video evidence show that your client could not have moved from the right lane to the left lane as the officer signaled him to do?
Yes, I think to answer that question, yes. I think the evidence does show that at the time the officer was signaling Mr. Drain to move over into the furthest lane, it would have been unsafe for him to do so. He would have either had to sped up to get past the semi in the front and cut the semi off, or slow down quick enough to get behind the semi before passing the stationary vehicle.
So nonetheless, couldn't the trial court have reached an opposite conclusion and concluded that the manifest weight of the evidence, based in part on the officer's testimony, was sufficient to show he acted reasonably? And if that's what the court concluded, then why don't you lose on this issue?
I think the main thing that the trial court got wrong in issuing its opinion as to the traffic stop violation was that Mr. Drain made no effort to attempt to move over into the furthest lane. And the evidence, both the testimony and the video evidence, flies in the face of that conclusion by the trial court.
Well, if the court accepted the officer's testimony that several seconds elapsed while your client remained in the right lane, and he could have slowed down enough to get behind the truck, why isn't that sufficient for the officer's justification?
Because the video evidence, I think, is stronger than the officer's testimony. It's the best evidence in this case because it shows exactly the situation as it was occurring as Mr. Drain was approaching. And I think the most important thing here is the fact that the statute itself uses the word approaching.
Go ahead.
Can I ask you about that, counsel? It has to use approaching, right? It doesn't, you can't require somebody to move over when you're at the vehicle. The cars don't move side to side. They have to gradually move. So is it surprising or problematic that it says approaching?
I don't think the word approaching is problematic. I think the fact that there's no further description beyond approaching is problematic. I think that it, when reasonably safe to do so, that sort of language would be better suited to be included in this sort of statute instead of just using the word approaching and not having any explanation beyond that to rely upon in issuing this sort of traffic ticket. Seeing no further questions, moving on to the next topic, whether or not Mr. Drain was in custody and subjected to custodial interrogation without the benefit of Miranda warnings at the time that deputy was asking him questions. So the issue here is obviously, would a reasonable person feel free to decline the deputy's demand?
Counsel, I have a question on this. If we agreed with you on this point, what exactly are the statements of the defendant you're seeking to suppress? What did he say?
The main statements that I would be seeking to suppress are the fact that he was bringing his grandmother a present and that he had the present in the vehicle. I think those...
Why does any of that matter?
Because if the defendant were to proceed on to trial, that would indicate some knowledge as to what is in the trunk. Without that statement, and with the suppression of all statements that occurred after the dog indicated on the vehicle, which were already suppressed by the trial court, that would only leave evidence that Mr. Drain was driving a rental vehicle in which his name was on, and inside the trunk there was a bag that contained narcotics.
Well, why would the statements at issue deal with what was inside the trunk at all, assuming the defendant wished to claim he didn't know what was in the trunk?
I'm not sure I understand that question, Your Honor. Would you repeat
it? What was the statement? He was going to his grandmother's house?
That's correct. Yes.
To bring her a present?
Yeah, well, it had been her birthday. Yes.
Okay. Did the statement say where the present was located?
No, it did not.
So there's no reason to think, and I wouldn't normally, that the present, whatever it was, happened to be in the trunk, is there?
No, there isn't, but I think if this case were to have proceeded to trial, just the mere fact that Mr. Drain said that he had a present for his grandmother in the vehicle, and lo and behold, there is a present in the trunk, and inside the present is where the narcotics are located, would infer some sort of knowledge that Mr. Drain knew what was inside that package, and therefore that would affect him at trial.
Okay, by the way, I want to, before your time runs out, I want to ask you about the dog sniff. You challenge the admissibility of the dog sniff because there was no evidence regarding the training of the dog or the handler, is that correct?
Yes, the state did not present, because it's their burden to show that the warrantless search of the car was reasonable, the state did not present any evidence to show that the reliability of the dog sniff, there was no foundation laid regarding the reliability.
In the absence of an objection to this offer of testimony, why would the state think it necessary, why would the court find it necessary that any further explication about the dog's ability or the handler's ability with the dog was required?
Well, I think that's kind of tied into the argument that his trial counsel was ineffective and that he did not object to the foundation of entering the dog's sniff and the dog result.
So two questions about that. Is it your claim that regarding the dog, his counsel was ineffective, so we should view this as a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel? Or are you claiming, leaving that aside, that the evidence was not sufficient for the trial court to consider the testimony of the officer about the dog and how he handled the dog and the dog sniff?
The latter, Judge. The trial court made the determination regarding the dog without the proper foundation, without the appropriate foundation as to the dog's reliability and making a positive alert on the vehicle.
I'm sorry, Justice Steigman.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
But this was the burden of the defendant to establish the unreliability, was it not? That's what the case law tells us.
Yes, Your Honor. So the initial burden, the prima facie burden, is on the defendant, and then it passes to the state to show that the warrantless search was reasonable. And then it's up to the state to establish the reliability of the mechanism in question. And in this case, that mechanism was the dog sniff, and no foundation was laid other than just simply.
Well, he testified. I mean, did he not? Hunt testified that he was a trained canine officer, that he and the dog had experience, that the dog was trained to detect narcotics. I mean, that was all in the record. That was part of the foundation.
He
had an opportunity to question him about that.
That is correct. The defense failed to respond to the state's questioning with any additional questioning as to the reliability of the dog. But answering your first question, the state merely asked if the officer had removed his canine from the vehicle, if he had walked the canine around the vehicle, and if the canine had alerted to the possible presence of narcotics in the vehicle, all of which answers were in the affirmative. However, there was no evidence presented as to the certification that this canine was a well-trained canine in any sense of the word.
And a requirement for admissibility?
Yes, Your Honor, I do believe that, because
what case so says?
Well, I compare it to, well, I will now compare it to a couple of other issues. For example, in a DUI case, even if the defense is not challenging the results themselves, the state still has to present that the machine that was used for the breathalyzer was certified.
Counsel, let me go back to my question. This is hardly the first dog sniff case that we've had. If this is a requirement that certification must be proved beyond the kind of testimony that was presented in this case, where's the case law that supports that?
Illinois versus Cabalas, as well as Florida versus Harris.
They deal with dog sniff cases?
They do, Your Honor.
And what do they say?
They detail that there needs to be at least some evidence presented that this was a well-trained canine that alerted to the car, alerted to the possible presence of narcotics in the car. Some evidence is what these two cases say. Florida versus Harris went much further than that. However, that was overruled by the United States Supreme Court. And those two cases together meant that at least some evidence, not the long list of different certifications and proof of past.
Well, some evidence like I'm a licensed dog handler and I've trained with this canine, would that be enough?
I think that a little bit more would be required than that, Judge. Just the fact that he was last certified in October of 2021 by the state of Illinois would be enough.
Your time is up, counsel. You have an opportunity, you will have an opportunity to address this again in rebuttal.
Thank
Mr. Londrigan.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel. Initially, addressing number one, whether or not we have a violation of Scott's law, I think the evidence is clear that we do. Clearly, the purpose of this law is to require drivers to move into the left-hand lane when approaching an emergency vehicle that has parked itself on the shoulder on the right-hand side of the roadway. This is pretty much an evidentiary argument. The trial court looked at the evidence and made a ruling based thereon that this defendant had more than appropriate time to observe the emergency vehicle and to make some effort to get into the left-hand lane.
And the evidence- the statute doesn't define the word possible, however. So how should that term be interpreted? Is this a subjective decision that the trial court makes? Is it objective? And how do we determine if that was against the man, if his finding was against the manifest weight of the evidence?
Well, I think the initial viewpoint of it would be an objective one, unless there was some reason, if the defendant was incapacitated or somehow handicapped in some fashion, that may apply to the situation to make it subjective. Hard to understand that without being presented with what the facts in that particular case might be. But in this instance, you know, you're looking at 11 seconds wherein the only effort admitted by the defendant that was made was the brakes being applied at some point prior to passing the emergency vehicle. So there's been no evidence that the defendant's vehicle attempted to make a movement into the left-hand lane. And that I think he has an affirmative obligation to do if the situation presents itself. And here the trial judge found that it did. I mean, this defendant had more than sufficient opportunity to get behind that semi-tractor trailer. To rule otherwise would be to suggest that he could parallel that tractor trailer indefinitely, which is clearly not the intent of the law. It says, if possible. So if the court finds that it is possible for this defendant to have moved over before encountering the emergency vehicle, then you're in violation of Scott's law. But as Justice Steigman pointed out, that's not what we're dealing with here. The issue is not whether we have a violation of the law, but rather, was it reasonable for the officer to believe that we had a violation of the law? Completely different standards. And under these circumstances, I think it's very reasonable for the officer to have concluded that there was a violation of the law and to have stopped the defendant's vehicle as a result thereof. The next issue I think that I wish to address is whether or not this stop was wrongfully prolonged. The stop appears to have occurred at around 11:31. And I think at 11:40, the second officer appears. So you've got about a 9-minute delay. During those 9 minutes, the arresting officer is asking appropriate questions, investigating the traffic stop, writing up the warning ticket, and taking normal procedures.
Opposing counsel contends in her brief that the mission of the stop was concluded at the time that the officer told the defendant that he was going to give him a warning ticket. Mm-hmm. How do you respond to that argument? Why are you saying that no, it wasn't, the mission wasn't concluded at that time?
I think that's the statement that the defendant is relying upon, Your Honor, is that the arresting officer stated at 11:39:30. So we're getting into seconds now. The officer says, looks like it's good to go. That's what the officer stated at 11:39 and 30 seconds. And 30 seconds later, the second officer arrived. And I think they're putting their defense on that language, suggesting that the arresting officer thought everything was concluded upon making that statement.
Well, what about writing the warning ticket? Is that included in the mission?
Yes, it is. And that is what is continuing. The officer did make that statement at 11:39 and 30 seconds that it looks like your license is good to go, or words to that effect. However, he was continuing to write the warning ticket at that time. And he testified that when his partner showed up, I think it was Deputy Wolf, when he showed up, he was still in the process of writing the warning ticket. When he got out of the vehicle with his canine, Officer Deputy Wolf got into the vehicle and continued writing the warning ticket. So the warning ticket was not complete upon Deputy Wolf's arrival.
So do we know how long it would take to write out a warning ticket? Is that something that takes minutes as opposed to a few seconds?
Well, in addition to the warning ticket, I mean, there's natural questions that are being asked of the defendant in an investigation, I guess it's called a leads investigation, where you call in and they give you background information. He was checking out the lease of the vehicle. He's checking out the status of the driver's license of the defendant, outstanding warrants, things of that nature.
He did all that first. And then he told the defendant, you're good to go. So he made that statement after he had done all the checks. Then he told him he was going to write out the warning ticket. I have that. It's 11:39:20. But, and it wasn't until then Wolf arrived that things started to change. But while that warning ticket was being written out, Officer Hunt was still asking him questions.
Yes.
So wasn't he then prolonging this stop by asking more questions?
Well, if he was asking him questions unrelated to the stop, if that's what you're inferring, Your Honor, then yes, it would be an unfair prolonged stop. But if the questions he was asking were related to the stop, having to do with his background investigation, then I would say no, it was not. However, just to be clear, I don't think the arresting officer stated to the defendant that, quote, you're good to go. I think he said that license looks like it's good to go. And that's a little different.
Counsel, isn't the criterion on delay not whether you ask questions unrelated or related? The question is whether or not it caused the delay in actually running out whatever you were running out. In other words, couldn't the officer have been writing out a warning ticket? And as doing so, as we know, being scriveners, just running out stuff, in the process, ask additional questions without creating any problem as far as the delay is concerned, unless there's an indication that somehow these additional questions caused the delay. In other words, if you are simultaneously writing out the warning ticket and talking to this guy and asking questions in the process, that would be okay, wouldn't it?
Absolutely, Judge. And if I inferred otherwise, I apologize. That's not my intent. Just trying.
Well, you seem to think that. That's why I'm raising this. You seem to suggest that there might be a problem with his asking questions, even though they occurred during the time he was writing out the warning ticket.
No, the questions would have to have prolonged the stop. Okay. You can ask him what kind of day he's having and where, you know, you can ask him anything you want, so long as it does not unnecessarily prolong the stop. And in this instance, because he was continuing to write the warning ticket throughout the stop cannot be deemed unnecessarily prolonged.
So can we look at this as pretextual, that the officer continued to talk to him, wrote the ticket out very slowly in order to get the other officer there so that he could get out of the squad and do the canine sniff?
If there was some evidence to support that, Judge, I believe you could, you know, look at it in that vein, but I don't think the evidence does support that. There's case law that suggests a stop of 10 or 15 or even as much as 18 to 20 minutes to write a warning ticket is not unnecessarily prolonged. I don't know the specific amount of time necessary, and I would argue that it probably changes from case to case, depending on the types of responses you get to your appropriate inquiries, you know, upon the initial stop. However, even if you were to believe that the writing of the ticket might have been somewhat prolonged, the officer did have reasonable suspicion that something was amiss here. There were questions that he gave to this defendant that the defendant answered erroneously or suspiciously. And he asked the defendant, in addition to that, whether or not he could conduct a dog sniff, and the defendant did not object to that search. So
why does that matter? He didn't need anyone's approval to conduct the dog sniff. And if it was going to be late, it's late. And if it's going to be not late, it's not late. What is asking for approval? Why is a nice gesture perhaps on his part, but it doesn't have anything to do with our assessment, does it? Or should it have anything to do with the trial court's assessment?
That if the court were to find that everything was concluded at the time of the request and the defendant did not object to the request, then he's basically not objecting to the additional time necessary to perform it. So if it was the court's position that immediately prior to requesting a dog sniff, all activity associated with the issuance of a warning ticket were complete and the defendant was ready to go, I think it would be the state's position that if the defendant does not object to a continuation of the stop necessary to perform the dog sniff, then he's waiving that objection at trial.
But that's not the state's theory in this case, is it? Your theory is that while the ticket was still being written out, the dog sniff occurred and a hit occurred. Wasn't that correct?
That is correct, Judge, but we're arguing in the alternative as well.
Oh, okay. Well, I just want to make sure, because it seems to me that if your first position is correct and the trial court so found and we agreed, then asking the defendant if he consented doesn't have anything to do with anything.
I would agree, Judge. Okay. And that is our initial position.
How do you respond to opposing counsel's argument that it was the state's burden to establish the foundation and reliability of the dog sniff, of the handler, and the ability of the dog to conduct the handler to conduct the search with the dog?
Well, I would first note that I've not found any authority that supports that position. You know, I've read the Harris case and the Cabalas case, and I don't see that either one of them suggests that. In the absence of the defendant objecting to the dog's reliability, which the defendant did not do in this instance. So that would be the initial position. In the alternative, I would suggest that we did, or the state did, present evidence of the dog's reliability by saying, this is my dog. You know, I've known this dog. I'm a trained canine handler. This is my canine. He alerted in a manner that is appropriate with his training, which suggests that the dog's been trained. And it suggests that the officer commonly or traditionally relies upon the animal to make appropriate responses when conducting these dog sniffs. So that is sufficient information to suggest that the dog is reliable and that this officer has relied on that dog in the past. And if the defendant then wants to challenge that, I think the state's made a prima facie case, even if we're required to. I'm not suggesting we were required to make a prima facie case, but if the court finds we are, I think we've done so in this instance. And it is now incumbent upon the defendant to raise this issue and investigate or present some type of evidence that the dog is unreliable.
So counsel, what's the bottom of that scale? What's the bare minimum that the state has to do before saying, you know, this is Fido here. He seems to bark a lot at drugs. What is the bare minimum to say that this is at least reliable enough to admit it, or at least require the defendant to challenge it?
Well, I think, Judge, if the state or the deputy testifies that he has used a trained canine sniffing dog to conduct a sniff, I think the state's met its burden. Yeah, without
knowing about the success rate, I mean,
that's correct.
He went to the plate. We don't know his batting average.
No, I don't think we need to get into that, Judge, unless the defendant wants to make an issue out of it. You know, if the defendant thinks that this dog for some reason is unreliable, the defendant has every right to raise that issue and the state has the burden to address it. However, if the defendant doesn't wish to challenge that, you know, the fact that we're using a common trained canine dog is sufficient. And I think it's traditionally done that way.
By the way, counsel, aside from the fact that no evidence was directly presented contesting the dog's training or that or the like, the defense counsel in his argument to the court on the motion to suppress raise any questions at all about the dog, such as, you know, Judge, there could have been more evidence about this dog and its reliability. The state could have presented that, but didn't do so. And maybe you should take that into consideration, or words to that effect. Was any such argument made?
No, not at all, Your Honor. There wasn't any argument made at all. And that's why I argued in my brief that I think this is the perfect case for forfeiture. You know, had the defendant really thought there was some issue with regard to the dog, he could have raised it. The state could have had an opportunity to satisfy the defendant's concerns. That wasn't done in this case, of course, because the defendant did not raise the issue.
So I asked Ms. Dalton if she was arguing both the trial court erred by admitting this or considering this evidence, and if she was addressing the dog sniff issue by claiming ineffective assistance of counsel. And if I understood it correctly, she said both. So you think the first of those two arguments has been forfeited because of no action at the trial level?
Absolutely. I think the first is forfeited. And I think the second, ineffective counsel has no support either, because there's been no evidence whatsoever presented anywhere in this record that would suggest the dog was unreliable. So she cannot, or the defendant cannot establish prejudice. And so,
well, her claim ineffective assistance of counsel would be, had trial counsel properly raised this and challenged the dog, apparently the claim is that the results probably would have been different. Or that's, I guess, the argument. What about that?
I think that's conjecture without some type of evidence to suggest that the dog, in fact, is unreliable. You know, there's no reason to suspect that a trial judge would have come to that conclusion and prohibited this evidence based on that assumption.
Couldn't trial court counsel, defendant's counsel, have determined that questioning Hunt further regarding his qualifications and the dog's reliability would have only bolstered that evidence?
Absolutely. I think it would have completely answered the question to the court's satisfaction, and we wouldn't be discussing this now.
Anything further, counsel?
Not if I answered Jacinto's question appropriately. I may have misunderstood it.
You didn't.
Okay. All right. If there's no further questions from the bench, thank you, Your Honors.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Landry. Ms. Dalton, any rebuttal, ma'am?
Yes, Your Honor. As to whether or not the stop was unlawfully prolonged, under Rodriguez, it's clear that the authority for seizure ends when the tasks tied to the traffic infraction are or reasonably should have been completed.
Well, pausing right there, two questions. First, are you contesting the finding that the officer is still writing a warning ticket when the dog hit on the car and alerted?
I do find that to be unbelievable, Judge, yes.
Well, that's not my question. My question is not what you found to be unbelievable, but is there some basis in the record to show that's what happened?
There's no basis in the record because that wasn't questioned of the officer, other than the fact that he claimed that he had not finished writing the warning ticket at the time that his brother officer appeared, but he could not recall how much of the ticket he had written. He had also testified that the warning ticket indicates basically the time, the date, the location, and what the person was pulled over for, which is four different pieces that he has to fill out in the matter of 9 minutes between the traffic stop and the time when Deputy Hunt informs Mr. Drain that his license looks like it's good to go.
Well,
record contain the ticket to show us that there's more than five pieces of information, like the defendant's name and address and driver's license? And it seems like there's a lot more than five pieces.
Even if there were three additional or four additional pieces, it's you're literally laying out very basic information that can be collected and written in the matter of minutes. I think that what happened here is that between the traffic stop and the time that Deputy Hunt informs Mr. Drain that his license looks like it's good to go, that warning ticket reasonably should have been completed. And I think that this court also made that determination in People versus Sadek that to hold otherwise might encourage officers to hold on to paperwork and purposely delay finishing a warning to prolong the stop, to continue questioning the defendant or conduct a dog sniff. And I think that's exactly what happened.
Go ahead.
Thank you. But the appellant did not put the warning ticket in evidence, I'm sorry, into the record for this court. Isn't that correct? We don't have it.
There was no warning ticket entered into evidence to present to the court. Otherwise, I certainly would have done so. The only thing that appellant could rely upon was the basic Illinois State Police blank warning ticket to show this court what at the very most might be included in a warning ticket. And even
we don't have that either.
That was attached as an exhibit to appellant's opening brief.
Counsel, did the trial court make a finding as to whether or not the writing of the warning ticket was unduly delayed so as to permit the dog sniff?
I think the trial court said that there was some delay, but the trial court did not find it to be an overabundance of delay. I don't think he used the word overabundance, but he didn't seem to find that it was enough delay to grant the defendant's motion. And I think that's where the trial court made an error, not relying on Rodriguez. And what Rodriguez clearly stands for is when the authority for the seizure ends, when the tasks tied to the stop reasonably should have been completed. And I think there was delay here purposefully in order to conduct the dog sniff. There was not enough to assert some sort of reasonable suspicion here. And if we were to compare this case again to Sadiq, because that was this court that made those decisions, and in comparing the two situations and circumstances of the offense in this case, essentially what Deputy Hunt says is that Mr. Drain was conversing fairly well. He wasn't moving a whole lot. He never said Mr. Drain was nervous or evasive. He said he had vague answers because Mr. Drain didn't give a specific street number for his grandmother's address. He said his breathing intensified at some point. In comparison to Sadiq, where the driver had stopped in the middle of the road, had been acting nervously, which was not contested by the appellant, the entirety of the traffic stop, amongst other factors that were considered reasonable suspicion that just don't exist in this case. The only other factor that Deputy Hunt indicated on the record was that Mr. Drain had said he had a misdemeanor arrest. The record's silent as to what Deputy Hunt found different from what was actually on his criminal history versus Mr. Drain's answer, but regardless of that fact, Deputy Hunt characterized the difference as nothing crazy and not a big deal.
Your time is up, counsel. Thank you and Mr. Landrigan for your presentations. The court will take this matter under advisement and stand in recess.